tuvieron una capacidad de circulación que ha sido sorprendente. En más de un sentido, este es un objeto de estudio muy particular. ¿Por qué? Porque en pocos minutos, en todo un territorio como Latinoamérica, apareció en páginas web, apareció en los noticieros en simultáneo. Yo estaba mirando a Televisa diciendo lo que, mira, textualmente repetía un canal argentino como el 26 o como el canal Crónica o como TN, en fin, todos estos de la red del Grupo Clarín. Entonces, si existe un proyecto de coordinación para la difusión de falsas informaciones, esto equivale a desfalcar algo que es de prioridad histórica para nosotros, que es el derecho a la información. Los pueblos tienen derecho a estar informados con información de calidad y con información verificable. Esto es un derecho humano fundamental.
Era el escritor Fernando Buen Abad hablando ante el micrófono del periodista Jorge Gestoso. Por su parte, el politólogo Atilio Porón explica la dimensión y alcance de la propaganda en el siglo XXI.
Hace unos años hubo una de esas famosas audiencias que se hacen en el Senado de Estados Unidos y en donde llamaron a uno de los jefes del Pentágono, ¿verdad? Lo que ya llaman un general de cuatro estrellas, ¿no? O sea, el grado máximo. Entonces, este hombre, bueno, respondió a las preguntas que le hacían los senadores sobre las capacidades militares de Estados Unidos, cómo estamos de armamento, necesita más aviones, más cohetería, más helicópteros, más tanques, díganos, etcétera, etcétera. Y el tipo dijo, mire, la verdad, no necesitamos más nada. Entonces, imagínate, sorpresa, porque además los senadores eso, ¿verdad?, y los diputados hacen su carrera política bancados por el complejo militar industrial. Si el complejo militar industrial no vende armas, no vende helicópteros, no se bajan los helicópteros en la guerra, los tipos se funden. Bueno, entonces el hombre dijo, mire, no necesitamos más armas, porque hoy en día el escenario fundamental de la guerra son los medios de comunicación. Son los medios de comunicación, ahí es donde tenemos que librar las grandes batallas, ya no más en las selvas tropicales o en los suburbios decadentes, estoy usando las palabras que él utilizó, en las selvas tropicales o los suburbios decadentes del tercer mundo, no, la batalla se libra en los medios hoy. Entonces, lo que vos estás leyendo y lo que mucha gente lee es un efecto de todo eso, la estrategia de Estados Unidos de utilizar un inmenso aparato mediático para decir mentiras, generar un clima de opinión, que eso rebote en la isla, te das cuenta, y a su vez alimentar protestas, que efectivamente las hubo, después me refiero a eso, pero no hay ninguna información que te permita decir de que Díaz-Canel ha renunciado o piensa renunciar. Es una locura. Pero claro, los tipos te manejan el 85% de las informaciones que circulan a nivel mundial. Cuando vos lees un diario, hacés de cuenta que 9 de cada 10 noticias, un poquito menos, son noticias que se originan por agencias de los Estados Unidos o agencias dependientes de Estados Unidos. Por ejemplo, puede ser el diario Clarín o Infobae, te das cuenta que tira una noticia, pero está todo articulado para decir esa mentira.
Era el politólogo Atilio Borón hablando ante el micrófono de Daniel De Vita.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Informativo Pacífica.
A continuación, Informativo Pacífica.
No te la pierdas.
Because we are the 99%.
La Secretaría de Marina de México ofrece disculpas a familiares de víctimas de desapariciones forzadas y ejecuciones extrajudiciales. La selva amazónica emite 1,000 millones de toneladas de dióxido de carbono al año y está provocando la aceleración del cambio climático, revela un estudio. La máquina colombiana productora de mercenarios está imparable y seguirá exportando matones a sueldo. Denuncian que un plan cóndor mediático está siendo aplicado en América Latina. A continuación, detalles de estas y otras noticias en esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Te saluda Fernando Velázquez. Quédate con nosotros.
Daremos comienzo a este programa con algunas notas del ámbito internacional preparadas por Norma Martínez.
La Secretaría de Marina de México ofreció el martes una disculpa pública a familiares de víctimas de desapariciones forzadas y ejecuciones extrajudiciales ocurridas en la ciudad de Nuevo Laredo, estado de Tamaulipas, en julio del 2018. Entre febrero y mayo de ese año, la Unidad de Operaciones Especiales de la Marina detuvo arbitrariamente a 27 personas y 12 fueron encontradas sin vida. Ya en abril fueron arrestados 30 marinos involucrados en el delito. El contraalmirante Ramiro Lobato Camacho, titular de la Unidad de Promoción y Protección de los Derechos Humanos de la Marina, fue el encargado de ofrecer la disculpa pública a las familias de las víctimas.
La Secretaría de Marina Armada de México ofrece una disculpa pública. Esta institución del Estado mexicano lamenta profundamente la situación, por lo que se compromete a continuar colaborando ampliamente con las autoridades,
así como a agotar todos.
And coming up next on the stream of free radio at freakradio.org or on your Huff website, huffsantacruz.org, at Lost and Latest Shows, it's Bathrop Spears Broadsides, the July 15th, 2021 edition, with interviews likely to be happening with Cornerstone Carol Denny of Berkeley, Katzenjammer Keith McHenry of Santa Cruz, and a few other bits, odds, and pieces, maybe even a mini flashback, which I don't usually do on Thursdays, but I may do today. So stay with me, and that's what you'll get.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So I'm going to begin this show, because I intend to be calling up Carol Denny, who I call Cornerstone Carol, activist, singer, writer, satirist up in Berkeley, longtime resident there, about this story which I've been following in other publications, the Berkeley Daily Planet online and Berkeley Side, which is an online publication as well. I think both of those are actually hard copy, or might be hard copy, up in Berkeley. But in the San Francisco Chronicle second section today, Thursday, July 15th, there is an article by Bob Agelko, and it reads, UC to pay Berkeley $83 million to drop case. That's University of California. The city of Berkeley is dropping its objections to a University of California construction project on the northeast edge of the campus and to continued increases in UC Berkeley enrollment in exchange for $82.64 million over the next 16 years to cover the city's added costs in police and fire safety and other services. In the settlement, Berkeley also agreed to withdraw lawsuits over the university's plans for student housing at People's Park. And this is an issue we've been following with some intensity when we bring it up. And the 750 Anchor House project on the northwest side of campus to a beach volleyball facility for women at Clark Kerr campus, six blocks southeast of the main campus, and to UC's long-range development plan that projects 48,200 students by 2036, an increase of more than 5,000 students. In addition to the payments, the city said the university agreed to improve streets and provide other services for residents within a half mile of the construction project at Hearst and La Loma Avenues to comply with city zoning standards and to engage in, quote, collaborative planning for future projects in the city. The text of the settlement will not be disclosed publicly until the UC Board of Regents votes on final approval July 22nd. Berkeley's City Council approved the agreement in a closed-door session Tuesday night and has not disclosed how council members voted. The agreement will enable the city to continue to provide quality city services and maintain the character of its neighborhoods while extending UC's renowned education to the next generation of students, Mayor Jesse Arguin said in a statement. UC Berkeley Chancellor Carol Christ, or is it Christ, I don't know, said the settlement would provide housing that students need while promoting cooperation with the city. But the settlement is not binding on neighborhood groups that have filed their own suits over UC's construction plans and enrollment increases. We're not dropping our opposition, said Arlene Silk, community group called Berkeley Citizens for a Better Plan, noting that Berkeley has estimated a cost from university projects at $21 million a year, four times the amount of the settlement. Silk said the UC has bought off one antagonist cheaply, but it won't be able to buy off all of us. But Arguin said in an interview that while all the agreement doesn't fully cover the city's expenses, it's still one of, quote, the largest settlements a UC campus has provided with a host city. I remind you, my opinion of Jesse Arguin is as a sort of a sellout supreme. That's what I call Jesse Arguin. But let's see what Carol Denny has to say about all this. She will probably have some choice words. In fact, she's already written about it herself on the Berkeley Daily Planet, and no doubt in one of her, if not already, one of her forthcoming Pepper Spray Times issues, which is a monthly publication that satirizes and educates at the same time. You may laugh, you may cry, you can snicker, and you can sneer at the same time as you get educated as to what's happening. So I'm giving her a call, and we should reach her because I actually got a hold, she got a hold of me a few minutes ago, but I was in the midst of another call. So let's see if I can get back to her. Carol Denny.
Hey.
Well, you are on the air if you want to be.
Sure.
Okay, well, I've just read the first half of the San Francisco Chronicle's Bob Agelko story on UC's deal with Jesse Arguin, your Führer, I mean your mayor up there. So I know you have plenty to say about that, but probably other things as well. So why don't you take the mic and take us away?
So, this is the result of what, you guys are a host city to a UC campus, so you know there's some friction along the way. One of the things that happens in Berkeley is, you know, they're supposed to have a long-range development plan. The citizens of Berkeley and, you know, we're all supposed to get a chance to look at that plan and ideally agree on that plan. In this case, the University of California at Berkeley's chancellor, that Chancellor Carol Crist, unveiled a plan that called for an extraordinary expansion that would accommodate this over-enrollment, well over, I mean, thousands and thousands of students over what they had agreed to in their last long-range development plan.
And when was that, Carol?
I think they're supposed to happen every 5 years. I could be wrong about that. But the plan we last had was nonsense because we noticed, you know, instead of like two or three people under every overpass, there'd be 20 or 50 or 150. I mean, what has been happening in the past several decades is the University of California at Berkeley has been just putting so many people onto their rolls and not only not providing housing for them, they were pretending they weren't there. They were lying to the courts. They were lying to the city. They were lying about what they were doing in order to make an enormous amount of money, especially by admitting an extraordinary ratio of out-of-state students and who pay about three times as much as in-state students pay. Of course, this comes at the expense of in-state students. So anyway, it took a long time, but finally the city of Berkeley caught on. Certainly the neighborhoods and the people who live here caught on. We are paying for all of the police, all the sewers, all of the, all of the infrastructure and city services that accommodate all these people as they wrench their way from frat house to frat house and so forth. So we were, several neighborhood groups and the city successfully sued the University of California, won in court only about a week ago. There's been a series of victories over UC's expansion plans. And then Mayor Ottagine, our Mayor Jesse Ottagine, set up a closed session, meaning like the city council's there and their staff are there, but the public and the press has no way in, and just gave away the store.
And also the city council's sworn to secrecy about this issue, right?
Well, interestingly enough, that's where there's a lot of confusion right now, because of course they claimed that they came, you know, they announced at the other end of this closed session that there had been no reportable action, I think was the exact phrase that the city attorney was allowed to say. No reportable action. Hard on its heels, I mean, within seconds, there was not just a press release from the mayor's office, but also a video of him shaking hands with Chancellor Crist, saying what a great partnership they had and, you know, how good it was, huff, puff, you know, in the closed session, and saying that they had made an agreement about essentially just selling out our landmarks, our low-income housing, People's Park, the north side, the south side, the hills. There are all these issues that were being considered, open for destruction and, you know, huge buildings and remaking the entire town. In exchange, that Jesse is allowing them to do all of this stuff, even though he, you know, the Berkeley City Council, for instance, unanimously supported the effort to save one of our landmarks that is full of rent-controlled housing, and it is right downtown, and it is considered to be, it was just bought by UC, and so the city council stood up for the students and the tenants in that building and said, no, you know, we're sending them the message that we protect rent-controlled housing and low-income housing and certainly this landmark building.
What's the name of that building, Carol?
It's 2021 Walnut Street.
Mm-hmm.
And they reversed themselves by, in apparently this secret meeting they just had on Tuesday. So, but did they? Because it violated the Brown Act every which way. it is the public's business, you know, certainly if they're required to, you know, if they put up a stop sign at the corner of Hither and Yon, that's required to happen in public. The public has a right to know. But this they did all in secret and then claimed that they hadn't come to any decisions and then issued a press release saying that they had made all these decisions and they were withdrawing any legal action, even though they had won in the preliminary hearings on all of these legal actions. So they sold out the neighborhood groups they were working in conjunction with. They certainly put themselves at odds with the 1986 Measure L, which obligates the Berkeley City Council to protect open space, to acquire more of it, to make sure to enhance natural the public availability of natural settings and park space and open space and all of this stuff. That was a citywide vote that they can only go against if they have a citywide vote saying the opposite. And they didn't bother to do that. They just ignored it. So we certainly, those of us who are part of the People's Park Historic District Advocacy Group, are considering simply at least putting the Brown Act issues before a judge, among other things. We can challenge their acceptance of the long-range development plan because the judge in this case, a Judge Seligman, says in one of the settlements, or in one of the decisions, rather, that just came out legally in the past few weeks, it obligated, the judge obligated the city to pay attention to local zoning, to do everything that, I guess it was 1988, they passed a Measure M, M as in Mary, that obligates, where the citywide, the citizens of Berkeley, obligated the University of California to pay attention to zoning and pay attention to the things that we have democratically organized to govern our city and guide its planning. So I don't really understand how what the city's doing. It seems to be doing everything at once by contradicting itself, even contradicting its own secrecy by sending out a press release immediately after the secret session. So what's going on? I guess we're in a circus up here. It's really circus-like behavior. There was at least one member of the city council who dissented. That was Kate Harrison, who represents District 4. But that means eight of them went along with this confusion, reversing their own vote on 2021 Walnut. This is the tenant building that's also a landmark that is rent-controlled, which they're going to knock down and do what they do so well, put up luxury student housing. Now, I don't know. I'm so curious to know if this is happening in Santa Cruz because I did not realize that it's happening nationwide. The captive audience you have, if you are a real estate developer, are college students because they got to live somewhere nearby the campus, or they want to live somewhere nearby the campus, and there's only so far away from it that they can afford to get before they're late to class every day or can't get there at all. So what they've done in many other cities is build for very, very wealthy students. Meaning, instead of, I don't know, when I went to school at Berkeley and I was in a dorm where there was a bathroom down the hall, shared dining facilities, you know, basically. Are you there? I'm sort of hearing
that. Oh, yeah, no, I'm still here.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, they build for low-cost living because the assumption is that most students are poor. Or, you know, the money they'll make someday hasn't happened yet. Well, they're building here in Berkeley stuff where you have not only a private room and a private bathroom, but you have access to a billiard parlor and your own private fitness center and private outdoor areas so you don't have to mingle with the riffraff and stuff like that. Believe me, the dorm I lived in had nothing at all like that. Mm-hmm. So it's a very different landscape, and the way they're doing this is not to spend any public money on it, but to take public land and hand it over to private developers and then just take a piece of the profit. So it's severely profitable if you are building for luxury housing for well-off students. And the solid third of students who were from out of state generally are wealthy students. Many of them are from other countries and, you know, are tucking in, you know, the fifths of 5 degrees so that they, you know, can just sort of spend an eternity burnishing another PhD rather than, I don't know, entering the workforce. This is apparently very popular with among the wealthy. So I didn't realize, of course, you don't realize this is happening until it's happened. So we have all of this really high-end housing that is not available to you, my friend, not available to me, not available to anyone who isn't currently enrolled in the UC system, which guarantees that their students will turn over fairly rapidly, and they will be able to raise the rent as much as they want because California's Costa-Hawkins law got rid of rent control. So there you have it. Millions to be made on by the University of California as it buys up all the available land in its surrounding areas, which creates an obvious hardship for the rest of us. So we thought we had them when we proved in court that they were lying in their paperwork and certainly in this long-range development plan about how many students were actually on that campus. But we were, you know, people were starting to figure that out just from counting the amount of people, amount of even UC students sleeping on benches at night. But
could this closed session move be a response to the court victory that you had earlier?
Well, how would you suggest that it intersects? I'm very confused by it. I don't see why they would want to meet in closed session. I know what they're doing is ugly. It is a reversal of, well, Jesse Ottegien in particular, when he was running for mayor, made all kinds of promises that he broke it instantly. And I've been in opposition to him from the very first day of his, when he made a very public show of his inauguration day and had everybody come up and be a big human peace sign up in the park that is close to City Hall. And then on the other side of City Hall, he took an encampment of people, many of whom were friends of mine, and swept them while TV cameras were right on the other side of City Hall. You know, the front of City Hall was a horror story of people having everything they own thrown into dumpsters. That's him. That is him. When people have affection for him, I'm just baffled. I'm completely baffled because, like, it's one thing to do that and say, you know, and stand there and say, this is my policy, I affirm it. It's quite another thing to get yourself into office because you claimed you would not only never do that, but you would have a free campground for people who couldn't afford, didn't have any place to go. You would. He made so many promises on the issue of housing and homelessness that it's stomach-turning.
But now it's time for a musical break. Here is Gentrification Town, a David Rovick song.
I've moved out of three cities because I couldn't pay the rent. Folks like me weren't welcome, so I packed it up and went. It's always the same story. I find a place I want to be, and soon enough I'm joined by all the other refugees. Then watch the websites warble. This is the hippest place to hang. Hey, check out Division. It's the sweetest thing since Tang. Then watch the millionaires come in, build a luxury hotel, sipping coffee on the sidewalk, saying, isn't this place swell? Rents are going up, and the neighborhood's going down. Here in Gentrification Town, see the families leave. the city. Watch how they accept their fate, except the ones who had the timing right and bought some real estate. The ones who had the timing and the ones who had the credit. The ones who paid attention to whoever it was who said it. This is a nation that won't suffer utopians or fools. He who has the gold rules. He who has the gold, he who bought the stock, he who is the landlord who owns your block. Rents are going up and the neighborhood's going down. Here in gentrification town. They say you can't blame the yuppies. They're just responding to the will of the market and the strength of the U.S. dollar bill. But the dollar's only strong if you have some to your name. Otherwise, you're on the business end of the game. The end that just stays home because they can't afford the show. The end that has to pack their things and find a place to go. The new hit place to be for a little while. Then the wrecking balls move in and chase us out again. Rents are going up and the neighborhood's going down. Here in gentrification town. Rents are going up and the neighborhood's going down. Here in gentrification town. Gentrification town.
To go through them all now. I mean, everything that we needed and wanted, the decriminalization of sleeping in your own damn car was just one of them. We've needed that for decades. And they just, not only did he not do that, but he made it much harder even to sleep in your RV, which is what RVs are for. So, this guy really is a monster, and I just made a cartoon just now where people are puzzling over what when you sell out in this spectacularly hypocritical way, what are they offering you? And we can't figure it out, because if you're offered, for instance, a vice chancellorship on, you know, that's like the sweet money on campus. You sort of have a job, but it sort of doesn't matter if you do it. And you get to wander around and have lunch all the time and wear suits and look important. We figured he was going for one of those, but he'd have to live here. In order to get that job and enjoy that job, people would have to not spit in your water glass at the high-end restaurants. And, oh, my God, nobody's going to forget this moment. Not if I can help it anyway.
Do you think that, I mean, this isn't the first, although this sounds like the first really major sellout that Arguin has done, but I've been, an inveterate critic of this guy since, and the city council generally, partially because of my hostility toward politicians generally. I mean, it depends, obviously, on who you're dealing with and what the issue is. But there have been prior incidents where Arguin has, as you pointed out, sold out the RV dwellers, sold out the people that got swept and so forth. And yet, was there much? Did people show up when he was dining downtown and with signs or with anger or with even just mild protest? Did that happen?
Over the RVs?
Over anything in the last 2 years?
No, yes, yes.
Good.
We have a really well-organized group that focused, for instance, the RV group. Creative, beautiful, they at least made him work for it. But he has the votes on the Berkeley City Council because, hey, people hate the poor. They hate RVs. They hate tents. You know, there's just no way around the frank fact that your city council and mine gets a lot out of visual poverty because everybody walks by with their nose in the air and says, well, aren't you going to do something about this? And doesn't care what happens to those people, the people they consider less than human. We have that same electorate here.
Mm-hmm.
We have that same city council here. And they don't really care how much opprobrium is heaped on them in the city council meetings or in the predictably from people like me in the press. They because they know they got the hills. What's interesting, though, is that they just, now they're after passing something that allows, you know, the big-ass mansions with their big-ass property to be subdivided. And I got to say, you know, as soon as one of those places goes on the air, what they want is for these rapacious developers who have ravaged our town in the flatlands to be able to do the same thing to the hills and put up apartment buildings and make mincemeat of anything resembling a natural landscape in the front, in the back, on the side, sides of them. So people are tearing their hair out. They're, you know, Jesse Adegeen has not endeared himself to the wealthy by saying, sure, like, let's boot zoning up in the hills and just let developers do whatever they want. So we'll see. The racism at the foot of most of the housing policy is fascinating to me, because part of how he got into office is being the first Hispanic mayor. Everybody thought that would be a great idea. But how he got there at all as a candidate is that he was just a Berkeley Citizens Action lackey. For years and years and years, he worked on everybody else's campaign and was an aide in other people's city council person's office. So, you know, he sort of waited his turn. Then he gets into office and basically has no moral compass, has no values, nothing. So it's pretty bad. For instance, on environmental issues, people who are knowledgeable about development and what is the green way to develop anything, the greenest way to develop anything is low-rise and rehab. So you take whatever buildings are already in existence and you just repurpose them to whatever your new need is, and you don't go up because it ends up displacing it. They need to dig deep to do that, and you end up shaking up the watershed. People's parks, 17 stories of concrete, for instance, is right over the North Fork of Derby Creek. So that land is going to settle, will continue to settle. Now we're in the middle of a drought that is so serious that everything they knew about that land and its hydrology that they studied 20 years ago, and they did, they know nothing about it now. And they can't make any predictions that will be sensible for the future, because we really don't know what we're gonna be facing. So it's fascinating to me. He doesn't care about this. If you were a sensible builder and you were concerned about the safety of the people who lived in that building, oh boy, would you care, considering the 18 inches that one part of one Embarcadero has sunk. You know, that used to be steady land, but not anymore. So I'm confused about this. I think that he just managed to offend everybody. Everybody who thinks parks are a great idea, everybody who respects landmarks, everybody who is tired of UC's duplicity. I don't see what he gets out of this. Right now, all I can think about when I try to imagine it is that I must be missing a piece.
Now, this Berkeley Citizens Alliance, or the BCA, whatever it is, where does it stand on the political spectrum?
I don't know. One of the things that's been fascinating to me is,
I mean, in the past, where has it stood? Is it, you know, does it favor support for the...
What BCA has always been about is a nominating mechanism.
Uh-huh.
So what it does is, you know, the people who agreed to work together for Tom Bates end up being the people who find a back room somewhere and decide who's going to be the next nominee. They never have open conventions, unlike the rent board used to, at least. The rent board has some kind of Zoom phenomenon that was arguably a disaster this year. But every other Berkeley political party has never had open conventions. And that's one of the reasons that I am not enchanted with any of them. I honestly think that without open conventions, you really can't argue that you represent anybody, and I don't think they do. But one of the things I noticed when Jesse Adegeen got into office was that everybody was all up for, like, the big human peace sign and didn't want to hear about the sweeps going on the other side of City Hall. When I pointed out to them that the very first thing he did, and this was before the first city council meeting over which he presided, was give himself a report on homelessness and housing where he just affirmed that he had satisfied all the concerns of our, what were we? We were a group of nonprofits like Dorothy Day House and People's Park Committee, and we must have had 30 or 40 of these groups that came together to make demands of him in exchange for our support. And they started to get off track and called me to come in, and I just went in with 15 demands that were very clear, and these were demands that he had already agreed to in private. So he agreed to them all. And they were things like a free campground, decriminalization of what did we have at the time, lying on a sidewalk or some absurd thing like that, decriminalization of poverty, basically, that covered a lot of ground. He agreed to all of them. And then in the very first meeting, he basically gave himself a report that said he had met all of the requirements to say that all of these concerns had been met, which was not only not true, it was an insult. And I wrote articles about it and walked around to places like the bigwigs in BCA and these political groups, and nobody cared.
Did anyone join you?
They were enchanted with the guy. No, they didn't join me. He was their shiny new toy, and they didn't want to hear from me. And it's pretty much been like that. Maybe it'll change now, but Robert, I got to say, this town is asleep. And I always feel like, I have a saying that I use a lot, you've probably heard me say, and it's that nobody moves till their butt's on fire. In other words, unless it's specifically happening to you in your house or at your house, unless they're setting fire to your hair, why should I care about them setting fire to my neighbor's hair? That's basically, this town is so complacent that I don't think anybody really cares until they see themselves specifically losing something. It's a pretty cynical perspective, but I think it describes Berkeley to a T, and it looks to me like Santa Cruz is in the running as well.
How long have you lived in Berkeley, Carol?
Since 1972. I came here as a student. The fence had just gone down in People's Park. People's Park was like my front yard since I lived at Davidson Hall in one of these dorms that was so crowded that basically you had a bed you could lie on or a chair you could sit in. But aside from that, you were walking either in or out of your room. There wasn't room to do anything else in there. So I spent a lot of time with my guitar playing in People's Park or walking up to the hills so I could play, have some privacy to play.
Now, my impression of those early 70s days was that there was something of a radical movement in Berkeley, that there was for example, the Police Review Commission that was established initially had a lot more power, and there was,
it didn't stop there. The students had just established ethnic studies. The park was established the first and the only community. It was a native plant garden that was accredited and open to the community. In other words, you could join in if you were a student and get credit for being a part of the native plant garden planning and planting. But you could also do it if you were a neighbor or you just liked to garden. and you could also get credit. That was a model that has never been replicated. Berkeley should be proud of it. Mayor Jesse Ottegain should be proud of it. But we apparently didn't get through to him.
So. Well, when did you see this shift changing in your, what, it's been, 50 years now that you've lived there?
I think people have always been complacent, and the wealthier you are, the more complacent you are.
Even back in the 70s?
Yeah, I just think that there's always a backlash from the super, super conservative times, and the 50s were pretty super conservative. So after the war, what we had was an influx of people who were not your typical college students. The typical college student was wealthy and male and white. But after the war, we had more diverse student body, more women, more people of color, more people who realized that the divisions, societal divisions that had been tolerated for decades were inappropriate, and were very much interested in building a better, fairer world.
So there was the BCA was active in those days as well, and there was an alternate organization that was...
Let me just clarify yet again that the BCA, like the Green Party here,
yeah,
like the Sierra Club here, operates mostly as a mechanism for nominating people to various political offices.
From smoke-filled rooms.
I got to say, now and then they'll do something. Like we were successful in passing a restrictions on the sale of sugar-sweetened beverages. That was a big one. But rarely does Berkeley deserve a whole lot of credit for doing something unique. It likes to wave that flag. We are the very first sanctuary city that existed in the nation. We're proud of that. But there aren't a whole lot of things like that. There are some.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just wondering if what the base is for. I mean, you're for raising the kind of opposition that you're kind of hoping will arise as a consequence of what seems to be the threat to both the hills as well as the lowlands.
Well, if I had to, if I had to make a case for there being any good news in this moment, it's that he has offended so many groups with so many different agendas that there's an opportunity for unity in places where before there was none. Only 2 years ago, I had someone who is a part of one of these neighborhood groups suing the university over a plan, one of their expansion plans, tell me, oh, well, the lawyer for our group will never talk to you guys, has no respect for you guys, you know, you People's Park people. Well, we're on the phone with them all day. Now, in the last 6 months, we've all been talking to that group and another group, and there's an enormous amount of effort to share resources and see what we can do to put together some kind of strength in numbers.
So this behavior by Arguin, this deal with the chancellor.
I correct you. It's Ottegain.
Thank you.
Ottegain.
Thank you. This deal with the mayor was anticipated by these folks who had previously held you at arm's length.
No. This was 2 years ago. One of the attorneys with one of the neighborhood groups said the worst thing. I remember asking him, "What is the worst thing that could happen?" And he just looked at me directly and said, "Ottegain sells out for money," and that's what he just did. He took the University of California, which should have been paying an enormous amount of money to cover the added cost to the city of the sewers and the city services, like transportation and police and stuff like that. They never were paying what the actual costs were to the city. Well, now they are going to pay at least some of the actual cost to the city, but they're also going to increase enrollment even more. So they're starting off by stepping right out of the equivalency that we may have at this moment if this deal goes through. But the money doesn't protect the landmarks. It doesn't protect the open space. And we're not sure what it does to the Berkeley City Council's obligations under Seligman's edict from the court to pay attention to zoning and respect the city's laws and stuff like that. Like, your guess is as good as mine. The courts are sort of the last element of enforcement, but I haven't seen a whole lot of enforcement from
the courts. Nope, not in the courts. Let me ask you, if you were explaining this to poor people or to folks who are outside, why should they give a shit about what's happening here?
Oh, my God. I don't have to explain anything to them.
Okay.
They know.
What would they say to you, then?
You know, the mayor has been completely disinterested in their welfare for a long time. And the only thing that was good news in a peculiar way was the pandemic, which at least for a period of time stopped the sweeps. But the sweeps are back on. We'll be looking at sweeps. I mean, there are sweeps, but they're sort of specific, and they try not to displace huge groups of people. But that's all about to change. So I don't think I have to explain anything to anyone who's, you know, been on our streets. Our streets are pretty obviously streets that belong to the merchants and nobody else.
Well, I'm not saying that, you know, it is obvious what the city does, this city and the city here in Santa Cruz as well. But it can seem arcane to people who are considering university expansion and issues that seem maybe removed from them, why they should care about those issues if they're poor. I know that sounds ridiculous, but...
I don't understand your question. I mean, the people most impacted by these greed-based moves are the poor.
Explain that. And I know, but how would you explain that?
Well, it didn't start with Otta Gein. Before him came Tom Bates, and before him came his wife, Lonnie Hancock. And what they discovered made them very, very popular and filled their election coffers with tons of money was to just turn to the developers hovering around their door and say, what do you want? And then give it to them. So what developers have been doing for decades is buying up low-income housing, knocking it all to hell, putting up condos, and making lots more money off the same square footage by only building housing for wealthy people. What we didn't have before was the University of California wholeheartedly participating in this game. And because they are creative bookkeepers to beat the band, what they have now done is, decided that they will buy up your scruffy low-income housing and hand it over to private developers, usually from Texas or Louisiana and places so far out of town that if you need, you know, the light bulb changed in the hallway, well, good luck with that. So they basically put it in the hands of for-profit private developers, and then they just tear off a piece. So they'll constantly get, you know, 10 or 15% of whatever the profit is out of the whole arrangement, and they call it housing.
But it's time for a musical break, so let's hear David Rovics sing about related issues.
I grew up in the suburbs, the ones where you do not stay. You either get rich when you grow up, or else you go away. I made a life in Boston, it was a wonderful city, before they turned it into a theme park for just the young and pretty. When they abolished rent control, I was living there. That's when the city lost its soul, people scattered everywhere. I don't know where they went, but they were rapidly replaced. Generations of communities entirely erased. I lived in San Francisco when the mayor swept the streets. I wasn't the kind of guy he wanted the tourists to meet. I moved to Seattle when Bill Gates and Kurt Cobain made the place the capital of the hipster gravy train. Now here in PDX, X. It's a CD on repeat. Developers smelled money, now they're in the driver's seat. Whole neighborhoods bulldozed as landlords tripled the rent. For so many, if not most, I'll tell you what that's meant. Goodbye. Goodbye, Portland town. Goodbye. Goodbye, Portland town. Any city change is only natural, I'd surmise. And this will happen faster when no one controls the rise of the prices of the houses and the interest rates of the month-to-month agreements in 48 states. Where it's not allowed to do what other countries do, where there are limits to the landlords, what they can do to you. Limits to their profits and to what they can destroy, so you might recognize the place you lived in as a boy. Goodbye. Goodbye, Portland town. Goodbye. Goodbye, Portland town. It's true that in the USA we're moving beyond race, and why did half the African Americans here leave the place between one census and the next one? 10 years later, it's like a bomb went off, but no one can find the creator. There wasn't any war here, just a lack of regulation, and folks who see a city as a source of wealth creation, a chance to make it big, a chance to make a buck. If you don't fit into their fortune making, they don't give a fuck. Goodbye. Goodbye, Portland town. Goodbye. Goodbye, Portland town.
And that was Goodbye Portland. You can find that again. It's on David Rovick's Oregon Songs playlist. I think it's available on the browser, your browser, on the Internet. It's possible that you may look for some minor contribution, but do it if you can. It's, as I said before, he's worth it.
What we didn't have before was the University of California wholeheartedly participating in this game, and because they are creative bookkeepers to beat the band, what they have now done is, decided that they will buy up your scruffy low-income housing and hand it over to private developers, usually from Texas or Louisiana and places so far out of town that if you need, the light bulb changed in the hallway, well, good luck with that. So they basically put it in the hands of for-profit private developers, and then they just tear off a piece. So they'll constantly get 10 or 15% of whatever the profit is out of the whole arrangement, and they call it housing. The thing is, it is a net reduction in the housing available to you, to me, to any old lady. To the people who need low-income housing, and that's a wide swath of people, but it is the majority of people in any town. The majority of people need that housing, and now it is only available to not just to students who are enrolled on campus, but to wealthy students who are enrolled on campus. So it takes the housing issues and makes them much, much worse. Now, this is not lost on the Berkeley City Council. They just don't care.
What about students? Are any lower income students concerned about this?
Yeah, we have the students have been great. I have to say, 10 years ago, if I started talking about the economics on campus and the LRDP, they wouldn't have known what I was talking about. But these guys really got it. I'm really, and I take credit for some of it because I've gone to some of their seminars and noticed that articles I've written are in their syllabus, and it cracks me up. But I'm really, really glad to say that there's a very there's a lot of very focused people on campus who know they're being used. They know they're pawns in a real estate game.
labor unions?
The unions, apparently that's what they had a closed session about on Wednesday. And I'm not sure I've heard anyone say anything about the long-range development. I'd be very interested to know.
How about the last summer's Black Lives Matter movement?
What about it?
Is this intersecting at all with that? Here in Santa Cruz, for poor people, it had a really strong intersection because the people who took direct action on the streets were concerned with, we don't have a large black homeless population here particularly, but they're the ones who removed the fences that were put up by Police Chief Andy Mills on several occasions and just deposited them back at the police department. And I'm just wondering if there's been any kind of that kind of direct action. Has any of that happened in Berkeley, and is it likely to happen again in response to this? Although it's hard to imagine how you fight this kind of corporate stuff on a direct level.
Well, we did. Yes, there. Our police review commission was transformed into something stronger just this past year, and believe me, it wasn't because the city council grew a pair or a conscience. It was because of Black Lives Matter, which had been, you know, gassed and beaten for simply walking by the Berkeley Police Department during a march in, it was 2014. So out of that, there's been a lot of change and a lot of activism. And, yeah, when they tried to fence off People's Park this past December, people just tore the fences down and put them all back on Sproul Plaza and say, you know, thanks for thinking of us, but no thanks.
Is that likely to be a response to this most recent decision, do you think?
We don't know what this decision really is right now. I think what I'm doing is scrambling to look at what documents are available to us, and that this is a little tough right now because of the secrecy factor. So we, at least the People's Park Historic District Advocacy Group, love that mouthful, is probably going to take them to court over the violations of the Brown Act. At which point, I mean, if it is confirmed that they violated the Brown Act, they don't have an agreement to put before the regents next week. The regents have to affirm the long-range development plan. I mean, it's their plan. When and if they confirm their long-range development plan, I guess they can assume that they have the Berkeley City Council's
in the back pocket?
Yeah. But that's what they already know, that the Berkeley City Council's in their back pocket with perhaps one dissenting vote. So they can do whatever they want right now. They really don't have to care about the citizens of Berkeley or the city or the landmarks or anything. I think they're just mostly the UC Regents are wealthy white men who just are there for show. They enjoy the sense of power it gives them, and I don't think that any of them know a thing about education, but or the city of Berkeley, or, you know, they run their big-ass businesses, and that's what they do.
Well, you know, in Santa Cruz, the two most left-leaning or truly progressive, in some respects, members of the city council, Chris Crone and his colleague, were in fact removed by recall. I assume, of course, that's because of out-of-town real estate money that helped with that. And is there any movement to recall the council or recall the mayor?
Interesting. Not that I've heard yet, but I do think that this will have repercussions. As a matter of fact, part of the reason I think so is that I have a relatively small mailing list that is mostly—it's about my music gigs. So I give people a heads up if I'm going to play somewhere. But I used it, which I don't often do. I used it to alert people that the Berkeley City Council was planning a secretive session, and that alone was to address the long-range development plan. Because I go back so far in the city of Berkeley, I remember when, of course, this was always held in public, and they would have a huge map of all of the land that they had acquired since last time in yellow. You know, they'd have in orange all the stuff they already owned, and then in yellow the stuff that they had just acquired, and then they'd have green stuff. Look out if you lived on that block, because this was the stuff they wanted to buy. So having these decisions made in privacy really offended me, and I wrote my own tight letter and gave a speech to the public comment opportunity before they went into the closed session, and it basically said, you know, I hope you're all taking note of what the Texas Democrats have done. They walked out to make sure that there was no quorum so that the Texas legislature could not go forward with racist attacks on voting rights, and said, you should be walking out too. There is no way you should be participating in secret on the public's business, not this. This affects the entire city, and it will be affecting us for decades. So, of course, they didn't pay any attention to what I had to say, but a lot of my friends I had no idea cared at all about the city's business, wrote in and then CC'd me on passionate letters where they've been angry for years about living even at the fringes of town where you wouldn't think, you know, when the campus inhales and exhales, it blows everything every which way in their neighborhood, but it does. Because there are so many places that UC has built where it is not, in fact, housing. It is a glorified dorm. And these dorm mini-mansions are everywhere, disrupting neighborhoods that used to, you know, be full of people who knew each other. You don't know as, you know, the dorms are run in a very different way, and it's constant turnover. So you don't really have the sense of knowing who your neighbors are. And they don't have the sense of really living there because these places aren't intended to be long-term housing. And that's what bothers me. It was like when they started to make the mini dorms all over town, it was just a taste of what was to come with short-term rentals through Airbnb and those horrifying reflections of, you know, what's been allowed to happen to the economy. So the gig economy undermined unions, and these short-term rentals undermined everything that honestly is good about housing. So to me, Jesse Adegeen let all of that happen, but Bates set the table, and so did Lonnie Hancock before him.
Hmm. Of course, now getting back to my favorite subject, sweeps. You say sweeps are increasing and selectively in Berkeley?
Sweeps never stopped in Berkeley, but what they did was, instead of showing up in the middle of the night and taking everybody, they would just, like, hammer on certain people. And part of me understands that there might be one person in one area who had really run afoul of the closest merchant, and so they'll pick that guy off. But I always remind people who think that the pandemic stopped sweeps entirely that they didn't. But they've made a great show later Tuesday night about ending the there was kind of a moratorium from the state
on shelter in place stuff.
Yeah, so I'm not sure how that will manifest, but they've been doing it. They've been going back and doing that under the overpass. I just came back from looking at the crowd on the overpass, and they're still there. It's just that they're constantly disrupted, so you constantly have to get up and move your stuff around and all of that. And what I love about that neighborhood is that they just help each other. They just consider it inevitable, help each other out, try to assist people who have mobility issues, and it's heartbreaking.
Is this Caltrans that's moving on them, or the city, or both?
This is both.
Mm-hmm. Because I know, you know, OSHA won a lawsuit push another, last year or the year before. I guess it was last year. And that, I guess that didn't, that hasn't stopped them, I guess. Huh?
That's the thing. It's worth doing those lawsuits because it helps educate the judges anyway about the horror that's going on the streets around them, probably not in the neighborhood they live in, but it's not a long-term solution.
No, ma'am. It's only part of the puzzle and all that shit. So.
Yeah, it's these voters who put people into position on the Berkeley, on your city council and mine, and then send those people up into the state to higher office that are the problem. Mm. I never blame the politicians. The politicians, if you put a hot piece of pie in front of them, expect them to eat it. It's the people who put that pie in front of them that are the problem.
But often the choices that people have are very limited. That's the problem, too.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you have this in your town. Do you have instant runoff voting?
We do not.
Well, we put that in, and people still haven't quite grasped how powerful it is to have instant runoff voting, because here's what you can do. If you don't like your council representative, not only can you run, you can get three or four of your buddies to run. And then when it comes time to give a speech, you know, that person that you only hear from once every 4 years will give his or her speech. And then four or five of you will stand up. You'll all introduce yourselves, and you'll say, none of us want this job. One of us has to have it, and we don't care who has it, as long as it's not this jerk over here who did this and this and this and this. And you'll have a whole room full of people who weren't paying attention who go, oh, they did that? And then you point out, they also didn't do this and this and this. And you can instantly have an impact, because the votes that come your way, if you don't hit a certain ratio, will turn into the votes for your buddy. And I watched them flip District 2 that way. The thing is, now the Berkeley City Council has caught on, the mayor in particular has caught on to doing that. And he, you know, once the citizens get their own representation, he'll put some he'll plant some people to run who basically are people who rubber stamp everything that he wants. And that's why we have the city council we have right now.
But you say it has been successful to some extent.
It is successful when you can get four or five people to run in a district. But that's very hard to do. People don't want to. They think the city council is doing fine because they don't hear anything about it. We've lost our newspapers. We really don't have coverage. You have to fight for it and find it. And if you're a reporter, nobody pays you. And I can speak as a satirist. Nobody pays you, even though you're promised that you will be paid. Everything dried up in the pandemic. You know, I'm a professional cartoonist who hasn't seen a paycheck in over a year. It's just very, very hard right now. I don't know where we're going, but it's not good news. I think in a lot of ways, though, it's better to know, you know, it's better to know that they're all just a bunch of pirates, and that's important to know.
Yep. Eviction crisis hitting Berkeley?
Well, yes. I think they're, what did they just pass? I got to go back. I was so, we went into overdrive after the closed session, so I'm not sure exactly what they passed on the agenda on Tuesday, so I better not even try to speak to it. I'm not sure what's going on.
Next time we can talk about that.
Okay. How are you doing?
I'm a little under the weather, but double-checking with my health and making sure everything is okie-dokie. Otherwise, it's the police haven't moved on San Lorenzo Park benchlands.
I was just going to ask, because I heard a threat a couple weeks ago, I guess. And what, they backed off?
Well, the police didn't back off. Unfortunately, the threat was and is that the courts have lifted the injunction protecting the benchlands. And the police now have the option, if the city wants them to, and the city manager was given the usual dictatorial powers, which were extended to the end of September, I think, something like that, or maybe it's the end of August. And the benchlands are growing. There's like, even this, today's newspaper here, our local Sent Anal, as I call it, or the Sentinel, as they call it, which is front page story about 240 tents, which, you know, that's hundreds of people in the benchlands. And they're still there, but the question is, because the city is driving people out of the Poganip, which is the nearby wooded areas, and drove hundreds of people away from campgrounds along Highway 1 and Highway 9 with no place for them to go, they didn't even offer a place. I mean, usually they'll want run around and say, well, here, you can go here, there, and there are all these wonderful waiting lists you can sign up for and so forth. But they didn't do that this time. They just said, move. And people, unfortunately, or fortunately, because people do what they need to, moved. And some of them moved into the benchlands, although they were told there's only, you can only have 140 tents there. Well, people are making more tents, and the city is turning a blind eye for the moment, but they don't have the protection of the court anymore.
Why did the court protection evaporate?
Well, I have my own opinion, which is that I'm critical of the way the Union of the Homeless handled it. But it was the COVID-19 lifting, the claim that enough people have been vaccinated in the area, that the CDC is now kind of looser in its guidelines, that if people choose not to be vaccinated, and there are many homeless folks who choose not to be vaccinated, that's their choice, and we can't force them. But that's how it goes. And therefore, an injunction isn't needed because, and this was the main thing, I think, the attorney, Anthony Prince, presenting this, did not present enough evidence of the city's bad faith in the past in claiming it had different shelter when, in fact, it did not, which is, I think, something that persuaded the Chico judge, Judge England, 3 days ago, to maintain, actually to grant the preliminary injunction for Chico's homeless. And not just for one campground, but citywide. So it's not that the police are moving on the benchlands now, but I'm encouraging housed folks and homeless folks to be prepared for that eventuality and to have some strategy around it. And some groups are at least talking about that, so that's a good thing. But it really requires people mobilizing the way they did this winter, when people came out in massive numbers, stopped the police on one occasion, and the next day an injunction was, or a temporary restraining order was granted, which turned into a preliminary injunction and lasted for 4 or 5 months.
I remember, yeah. That was inspiring, and we have some similar things happening here, where it's specific to different regions of the town, but there's a lot of support for people, and especially when we hear that things are, that the city wants to move on people. The trouble is it's very hard. We're not as organized as I would like to see us, but all you can do is keep trying.
Well, that sounds to me like what you're doing. Which I appreciate, and particularly in your new color handouts or put-outs or printouts, which you send down my way.
Uh-huh.
The Pepper Spray Times, for those who are listening, check out Carol Denny online, and she can subscribe directly to you, right?
Sure, yeah. So I do have a website, and if you want to subscribe to the Pepper Spray Times, you are most welcome to do so. It is also available online at the Berkeley Daily Planet, which is an online newspaper, and they always have a couple of the latest issues up there.
And also, of course, you have written on a lot of these subjects and given a lot of history on your own website, as well as sung about it at length. Any new discs coming out, or YouTubes or iPods or whatever?
I wish I could say yes. It's been kind of busy.
Sounds like it.
I'm looking forward to taking all the I just refer to them as the pandemic songs, and turning them into a collection. Hope to be able to do that soon. I think the engineer I worked with last time is vaccinated and eager to get back to work, so I am too.
Yeah, I know David Rovix has taken his Oregon songs and put them all into a massive 50-song deal on YouTube, which I'm playing, actually, as a part of the show. So I'd love to hear more of your pandemic songs. And are any of them available now on YouTube?
If you go to the San Francisco Folk Festival website, I put 5 or 6 of them together in a YouTube presentation. So there are a lot of them there. You can enjoy at least some of them that way.
San Francisco Folks.
The San Francisco Free Folk Festival took place online this past June, and I was invited to be in it, and we all had to create video in order to do it. So it'll be me singing at my desk.
Excellent.
Songs from the pandemic.
Well, I will check it out, and who knows, maybe I'll steal a few.
Enjoy.
Hey, anything you want to add before we finally mercifully let you go?
Thank you to all the people who care about the things that we care about. I can only say, if you thought Santa Cruz was embarrassing, well, take a look at what our town just did, and you'll feel much better about your hometown.
Well, that's very sweet. And I will hope to hear from you again, and you should call me whenever you want.
All right. You take good care.
Take care, Carol.
Bye-bye.
Through the city, block by block. The MAX was full of people of most every class and creed. Shoppers, workers, travelers, graduates of greed. Christians, Buddhists, atheists, Jews and Muslims too. All aboard the Green Line to 42nd Avenue. But now many will remember that 26th of May. At least anyone who picked up the train that day. Some were coming from the airport, visiting the state. Some were getting off from work and heading for a date. Some were going to a party for the start of Ramadan. Some were heading to a meetup for fans of Comic-Con. Some were looking for a strip club, some for a Big Mac. One racist thug was looking for someone to attack. He chose 2 teenage girls to hear the things he had to say as he shouted at them on the train that day. Different race. No one knew beforehand today would be a test, or what might next have happened, but for mention Fletcher Best. We can ask where he came from when all is done and said, why he was so inspired by the ideas inside his head. But what we know for sure is 2 men lost their lives this way. That's what happened on the train that day.
And that was On a Train, a song for those, according to the notes, who lost their lives confronting a violent white supremacist who was yelling at girls on a train, one of whom was wearing a hijab. It's from the collection Ballad of a Wobbly in 2017. And here's a story that troubles me from today's Santa Cruz Sentinel, or Sentinel. It's by Jessica York, and it's headlined, Anti-Mask Advocate Released from Jail, David Rodriguez Found Competent for Trial. Santa Cruz. In a marked change of pace from coronavirus restrictions a month earlier, nearly 70 people squeezed Wednesday morning into a Santa Cruz County Superior Courtroom to heckle, applaud, and pray during David Rodriguez's hearing. Rodriguez, 39, of San Jose, is facing numerous misdemeanor and municipal infractions related to his anti-mask activities in and around Santa Cruz in the past year, including allegations from May of obstructing or intimidating business operators or customers, trespassing and petty theft at the New Leaf Community Markets on Fair Avenue. He pleaded not guilty to those most recent charges Wednesday. And I'll pause in the midst of this story to point out, I've never talked to Rodriguez. I did see him on the street once downtown when I was meeting some homeless union folks in, I think it was March, as we were urging the city to put people up in hotels rather than risk their health and the health of the community in COVID shelters, which were kind of, we had feared at the time, petri dishes for infection. We were wrong, it turned out, at least for that variant, though for this new variant, there is a apparently recent, there was a recent story that up in Santa Rosa, 47 were infected with coronavirus in a July 10th story that again came out of the Santa Cruz Sentinel. Which I'll probably read a little bit from later, but anyway, Rodriguez is an anti-masker, you might say, that who was urging people to feel they have a right not to wear a mask, and this was all. I don't actually have the details. I don't want to misquote Rodriguez, but that seemed to be part of his message. And he was being shunned by a lot of people. Some were listening with some interest. Others were sort of disturbed. This was across from the farmer's market on a Wednesday in downtown Santa Cruz. So that's the only experience I've had just near him. He was, you know, speaking loudly and boisterously, which I do, too, on different issues on the street. So I feel a kind of kinship there, though I don't know if I agree with his message. I can't really say in detail because I haven't had him on my show or talked to him at great length or read his stuff. I know there's a serious disagreement among some people I respect that as to whether how effective masking is, how effective vaccinations are, and how effective social distancing is. Now, I've myself chosen to socially distance and mask and get vaccinated, but that's my choice. The issue as to whether it should be mandatory is becoming increasingly serious, and this was one that came up earlier and is particularly important for folks outside because they are, at the moment, not suffering much from the disease, even though they've generally been unvaccinated. People are wondering, homeless people themselves, their providers, their advocates, medical sources, why this is true. And it's not been really researched, or as far as I've read online or in the print media. But that being the case, people have chosen not to be vaccinated. Some of them have a real serious mistrust of government agencies, not unjustified in many ways. In this particular case, hard to say. For me, anyway, but they're going to be facing problems if they choose to remain unvaccinated, as, for example, many people in the benchlands are. Problems being discrimination, ostracism, exclusion, and maybe even coercion, and that's going to be a real issue. In any case, here's more about this guy, Rodriguez. It's the petty theft at the New Leaf Community Markets is a misnomer to those who don't really know what happened at that market. I wasn't there, but when I read the stories and talked to people who were there at New Leaf, These are people who came in without masks. They were making a big deal of the fact that they want the right to walk through the store without masks themselves. I don't know how socially distanced they were from anybody else, but they wanted to be able to be served. They wanted to be served at a distance. Maybe they didn't. They didn't object to other people wearing masks, but they did not want to wear masks themselves. And they still wanted to be able to be treated as customers. And therefore, when they refused to be served, they put down money and took their goods anyway. Now, is that petty theft? You be the judge. Rodriguez, the story continues, regularly posts live videos on social media featuring his opposition to COVID-19 health and safety mandates and was involved in the Valentine's Day Operation Money Drop, that's what I was referring to, protest at the downtown Trader Joe's, the video for which went viral nationally. During Rodriguez's arraignment hearing on June 30th, this is a pretty outrageous thing you're about to hear, Judge Nancy de la Peña ordered him held without bail and appointed two experts to determine his mental capacity to face criminal charges. Without bail for petty theft and anti-mask advocacy. It's pretty serious shit, as far as I'm concerned, when the courts are backing this kind of repression. I don't have to be a fan of Rodriguez's views or position to be outraged and upset at this. Again, I don't know what happened in the court of Nancy de la Peña. I've heard other public defenders who are friends of mine, or other attorneys who are friends of mine, praise Nancy de la Peña. I've been pretty sarcastic about public defenders in Santa Cruz, because I think they're generally, however hard-worked and overworked a bunch, they're, you know, the 5 minutes in the hall crowd. And they haven't really helped homeless people to the extent that I think they need to have done. And they don't help defendants who don't really press. They're there to make plea bargains and get people out for the least amount of charges. I guess that's their sense of what it is, rather than overturn unconstitutional laws and go for the broader good of the community of people who are being oppressed by those laws. I'm thinking mostly of poor and homeless people. Based on those experts' recommendations about his mental capacity, Rodriguez's mental capacity, Judge Sida Cogliati on Wednesday declared Rodriguez competent to face charges. So he had to be held without bail for 15 days because she judged him incompetent. I really think that a loud, outspoken guy to find that person incompetent is a form of a really deceptive political repression in this situation. I know it's being done under a public health banner, and I understand that the concerns people have about others spreading COVID to less vulnerable people, but you don't declare them incompetent and remove their rights as a way of addressing this issue. If you want to charge them with something, you do so explicitly, openly, and with after probable cause and guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And you certainly don't withhold bail so they can't support themselves. Anyway, the story continues. At the request of his defense attorney, Michelle Lippard, Cogliati ordered Rodriguez to be released from jail under supervision with several conditions, a move met by his supporters with lengthy applause, which I kind of like, actually. I don't think courts should be this hushed and revered in authority. They are actually usually class warfare forums, which essentially ratify the warfare of the upper class and the police against poor people, generally. He spent some time in custody, and he knows what he needs to do to stay out of custody, Lippard told the judge. Public court attendees were forced to watch the hearing by live video from Department 1, located on the other side of the courthouse from Rodriguez's hearing Wednesday, before Cogliati in Department 6. So they wouldn't even allow the public into his department. Rodriguez himself, still held without bail in Santa Cruz County Main Jail at the time, was himself appearing remotely from the jailhouse courtroom, so they wouldn't even allow him in the courtroom. Bailiffs told the agitated crowd that they had been put in a different room from the regular court proceedings due to their behavior at a previous hearing, i.e. expressing themselves. You see, it's considered inappropriate to express yourself, even if that does not stop the court proceeding. That's also what city councils try to use, too, to beat back opposition, to intimidate the public that they're supposed to be representative of and listening to. Prior to his release, Cogliotti ordered that Rodriguez to not drive unless his vehicle was registered and had license plates, which has to do with what some activists on the right talk about, a sovereignty, that driving is not just a privilege but a right, and that you have to assign a contract with the government essentially to do it. I don't know all the ins and outs of it. I knew people who used that theory. I don't know how far they ever got with those arguments. To obey lawful orders issued by police, and to stay away from New Leaf, Moran Beach, Trader Joe's on Front Street, and Twin Lakes State Beach, probably places where he engaged in political protest. He also was, and you shouldn't be able to help force people to stay away from beaches where you engage in political protest. He also was ordered not to possess stolen property, told he would be subject to search and seizure at any time, with or without a warrant. Cogliotti sought confirmation that Rodriguez understood his conditions for his release and set his preliminary hearing for 9 a.m. July 23rd. I know exactly where these are, Rodriguez said, of the stay-away orders. I will not go to those places. So he surrendered his rights in that situation so he could get out of the 15-day jail cell hold. That's a story from the Santa Cruz Sentinel, July 15th, 2021. Again, not giving you any of the details of any of his arguments about the whole issue, really, any of his supporters' arguments, simply and sort of blows off the whole thing and really ignores the outrageousness of it all. The other article I mentioned to you earlier, Santa Rosa, also from the Sentinel on July 10th, 47 at Santa Rosa shelter infected with coronavirus. A total of 47 residents at a homeless shelter in Northern California have tested positive for the Delta variant of the coronavirus, officials said. The majority of those infected at the Samuel L. Jones Hall in Santa Rosa were unvaccinated. Janianne Holmes, who leads the homeless services at Catholic Church, the nonprofit managing the shelter, told the Press Democrat on Thursday. Santa Rosa is about, 60 miles north of San Francisco. I'm not sure how many miles, but it's north. Just one homeless resident has been hospitalized, Holmes said, and no one else with a positive test has severe symptoms. The outbreak at Sonoma County's largest homeless shelter has affected almost a third of the 153 residents and comes amid a broader uptick in local COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations, predominantly among unvaccinated people, the newspaper reported. So this is an exception to what we heard before, that homeless people, their experience before in different cities, not getting the coronavirus and not getting sick from it, not getting hospitalized, and not getting dead from it. The highly contagious Delta variant of the coronavirus has spread rapidly among the unvaccinated population, causing a rise in new cases and hospitalizations. It now accounts for most new infections in the state. In California, anyone 12 or over is eligible for the vaccine, but so far about 70% of that population in California has received at least one dose. Homeless people have been among the hardest to reach in the months-long inoculation campaign, and perhaps the hardest to convince. No records exist to say how many remain unvaccinated, the authorities say. The outbreak is only the second time the coronavirus has been detected at Sam Jones Hall in Santa Rosa. There was a smaller cluster of cases in January during the peak of the pandemic, Holmes said. Could be a kind of a crappy group home for other reasons, I guess, or group shelter. The Delta variant is reacting with the homeless population much differently than the original COVID situation, Holmes said. We've had very few cases for the entire pandemic. Across Sonoma County, 62 homeless people have tested positive within the last 2 weeks, according to Catherine Pack, a manager of the country's county health department's epidemiology team. That's a 48% jump in the homeless population's total COVID-19 caseload, which now stands at 191 since the start of the pandemic. Well, that's interesting. Let's listen to the latest update from Keith McHenry that I was able to catch earlier today, and we'll be passing on to you. So, partially through lazy editing, and partially through time pressures, but also because I think it actually shows, gives you a brief kind of view or ear into the life of a dedicated and busy Food Not Bombs activist who's involved in feeding people, as well as raising the issues that are more profound to the case that should ultimately end the need to try to go out and feed people. You're going to hear a lot of distracting stuff in here, but you'll also hear some stuff that's on target. So you be the judge as to what you think of it. I'm with Keith McHenry. It's around nearly 1 o'clock on July 15th. And Keith, you just left off, am I wrong, food at the Daily Food Not Bombs Survival Center?
No, this is like more complicated than that. I am trying to unload my vehicle of all the just random things that I've got in it. And are you going to back out? Let me back out first, yeah, because I was seeing. Okay, cool. Great, okay.
I can call you back, Keith.
No, I mean, it's just weird. Okay. So, now, yeah, because I was getting backed out, and the snowball van was backing out into the exact same place.
So where are you, anyway?
So I'm at the meal. But I'm here to unload water and to unload chairs so that I can, now I've got to go to the storage container and unload the broken tent parts that are in here. And then I got to come back down here to Jinja Joe's and get the first load of food that goes down to the benchlands. And so I got 2 or 3 loads.
So how many loads of food do you generally do each day?
Well, we do about 100, at least 100 meals, but it might be 150 meals sometimes.
And so how many loads is that for you? How is 150 meals?
Oh, it just depends. Well, you know, it's all random. It's, well, there's usually like 6 5-gallon hotel trays of food, and then random, and then 5-gallon bucket of salad, 5-gallon bucket of fruit salad, and then there will be random sandwiches and boxes of crackers and all kinds of things like
and
that.
And you transfer this from the Red Church or India Joe's to either the Food Not Bombs meal site or the Benchlands, right?
Yeah, well, so what happens on today is we've got 2 different pickups.
Today is Thursday.
It might be just a butt call from the guy who I do get pickups from. But what we do have is a delivery from Second Harvest of 2 pallets of food every week.
How much of the food is actually getting taken, and how short are you if you are short on, let's say, Thursdays?
We are able to not be short. But on occasion, we have mix-ups. So, for instance, for some reason, we occasionally have 2 kitchens happening at the same time, but not necessarily knowing much about what the other one is doing. And oddly enough, that's resulted in not enough food sometimes. So what we had, for instance, was we had 5-gallon hotel trays of food. In that case, probably beans, rice, stir fry, and baked potatoes. And the issue was that it ran out about 3 o'clock. And
because of an excess of customers, or
we should have had more. Yeah, we just every single thing was eaten, and we could have actually technically made enough, but we didn't. And so most days we actually, we'll do something like 6 5-gallon trays to 7 5-gallon trays plus the 2 5-gallon buckets of fruit salad and or other things, coleslaw, things like that. And that usually works, you know. That, and then, of course, we do a lot of coffee. That's pretty popular. That's usually now almost 3 of those containers. Definitely 2 every day.
How's the food situation in the benchlands?
Well, then what we've been doing that with that is we take like all kinds of like things that are easy to prepare or don't need to be prepared to people down there, and it normally it's once a week, and that's going to be this afternoon, and which is the main reason I've got to unload my car, so I have room for that, and it's random, you know, over the week, bread goes down there, and pastries and things like that from what we're doing, but then other groups go down there too. There's another place that takes the leftovers of their second harvest delivery, and they go down there. And it's similar to what we have. It's just a much smaller amount.
Now, you may have noticed in today's Sentinel, and if you've read their latest front page article, they estimate 230 tents down there. Maybe it's 230 people, I'm not sure, or something like that. Has that situation been increasing?
Yes, it is, and I think because of the new clearing of the Poconos and everything, that's going to, you know, won't be that every single person kicked out of those areas will be there, but some people certainly will find themselves there. And one of the things I found disturbing was this section where a vigilante group had gone out and provided GPS coordinates that they published on Nextdoor.com of all the camps in the wooded area, and kind of claiming they were doing it for fire protection, which I would agree that it's important not to be up there because of fires, but there should be really places for people to be. But to actually make public a GPS location of where you're living for other vigilantes, and the only people really allowed on Nextdoor are essentially people with no opinion about homelessness or hate homeless people, because anyone I know usually that has a supportive word about it gets kicked off. I've been kicked off.
Have you heard any reports from Poganip about vigilantes causing problems in the camps?
I haven't heard that. I do think, though, that it's just it's amazing that we could that could be just so calmly reported on in a newspaper in Santa Cruz as though there's nothing weird about it. It's kind of shocking.
Oh, it's their standard approach, I think, that they, you know, it's all about the fire danger. Although there's a little bit more space than usual, though it is still a minority of space in that article in today's paper, which maybe I'll be reading later, I don't know, which talks about one camper and how he does attempt to cautiously bank his fires and do his cooking in a safe way. And, I mean, people are going to be cooking. People are going to be, you know, doing life-sustaining behavior. And so that's something that has to be accommodated. And, you know, there's, of course, what's his name, Hadjuk, the fire boss, supposedly being very sympathetic. Oh, there should be places for people. We don't want to play whack-a-mole, says another fire official. But still, unless they're actually demanding of the city, since these are city officials who actually might be heard, and saying we cannot effectively control this unless you set up areas where people can actually know they can go without being harassed by the police, and that aren't, you know, barbed wire fenced off areas that are 7 miles out of town or something.
Right.
And I don't.
It's interesting that you know, yeah, they're not offering anything. They're just basically kicking people out. And I suspect that mainly what people, you know, it's just crazy. And the other thing is that people might hide more, you know, in the woods in more dangerous situations. You know, it's ridiculous. The whole thing's crazy. And then, of course, any fire happens, even if there's an unhoused person completely unrelated to it, will definitely be tagged with a homeless person burning down. Not unlikely to happen.
Yeah, no, I hear you there.
So for instance, the Hampton Inn Mission, I don't think anybody's in that. No one, you know, I've been talking to Ratner to get that building, you know. So if you want to, you know, take everybody from the Pocono, put them in the hotels that are being constructed or, you know, stuff like that.
Although there is concern now with the Delta virus of Corona, even though there was less communicability of the other, you know, we were concerned about this a year ago. You may remember Union of the Homeless and Huff concerned about putting people in, removing them from shelters and putting them in, you know, separate residences. I guess that's what you're talking about in this Mission Hotel thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a brand new Hampton Inn and it's not occupied. And, you know, it's got like 200 rooms probably and it would accommodate, you know, 200. You know, I mean, you could even have two people in a room, but probably better to have one person in a room or a couple or a family. So there's that. And then there's also has to be some kind of thing done about the, so like in safe parking, where there's like a whole drama there where we're not, you know, where it's people can't get in or people get kicked out or, you know, run into more people basically just don't qualify for all kinds of reasons. So then to kick people out of the Poconeps and all is, it's eventually going to be a crisis for the people that are actually...
Have you talked to many people who have gotten kicked out of the Poconep recently?
No, I've talked to somebody that was apparently kicked out of it.
At least it was mentioned in the paper yesterday and today.
So we had 60 people show up to push last night.
How'd that go?
And that went really well. And we had people. There's two ballot initiatives that were pointed out. A vacancy tax was one. What was the other? Is this the right place for this? Maybe. The other one was, so we talked about trying to stop the hotel at Laurel and Front Street where we're serving.
Now this film Push was about what, black money or dark money being put into hotels and developer stuff?
This was somehow to block. I forget the details, but it's to block the building of the the parking garage at the farmer's market.
No, but did you actually see the movie Push?
Yeah. Then we saw the movie Push. That was amazing. So this was a woman from the special rapporteur on the rights to housing in the UN. And she, it kind of reveals her increased information. She travels all over the world. And Blackstone is like one of the largest publishers, buyers of rental property and so on. So it just showed that it was like a total global financial transfer and ownership to hedge funds and pension plans and stuff like that. I didn't think it was very. She was trying to set up a way of city government opposing this, and that to me seemed a little unrealistic, but she had mayors from a few, London and stuff like that, Barcelona, trying to create, like, barriers to speculation that would also be legal.
And you, of course, contacted Donna Myers immediately for her part.
Yeah, right. I mean, that was the interesting thing. We kind of like, wow, really? So anyways, that's how that was.
Now we'll push the movie be shown again.
Yes, we're showing it on Sunday, the 15th of August, at the Research Center for Nonviolence.
Okay.
For people that missed it.
You also have a couple of cleanups coming up. I'm not a big fan of cleanups. It reminds me of telling people in the camps to straighten up their camps because they're so dirty and they're outside and they have no showers and no restrooms. But you want to talk a little bit about those two events that are coming up?
Yeah, I don't recall it, actually, sadly, the times, although I know it just got announced.
I think I may have I may be able to help you with that if I can find it online as you talk about it. So tell me what this actually is.
I think I should put these up here. Yeah, I could put the tents up here. Yeah, I find it really alarming that you know, like, people can go online to find camps in the woods by vigilantes who just decide they're going to do that. That's like doxing unhoused people that are already unprotected. That's crazy. And even though it's not the name of the person, you know, people that have people living outside, they're not worried about people having names. They don't even think people have names, probably.
So I have found the two events, that the San Lorenzo Riverbanks cleanup sessions, which involve various groups, Saturday, July 17th, that's day after tomorrow, 11 to 1, meet in San Lorenzo Park, Dakota Street entrance, near the duck pond and the pedestrian bridge. That's the one that's coming up immediately. And then Friday, July 23rd, that, I guess that's next week, after the 5 p.m. Benchlands meeting, meet in San Lorenzo Park near the picnic tables behind the courthouse. And I guess you do have a meeting of the... So the most immediate thing is coming up on Saturday at 11 a.m. In San Lorenzo Park, right near the duck pond at the Dakota Street entrance, for folks who want to... apparently there are teams that are going to be dressing in layers and wear sturdy closed-toe shoes, what they suggest, prepare for sun heat, bring your own bottle, garden gloves, and trash, picker-upper, rake, shovel. And they will have supplies, water, and snacks. I'm reading from Sanitation for the People's handout. Requested to sign up in advance if participants who aren't residents of the riverbanks and expected to follow a community code of conduct, which is mentioned online. It's coordinated by the Benchlands Camp Council, Sanitation for the People, Food Not Bombs, Santa Cruz Homeless Union, and I believe, though it was not mentioned, Huff also supports this venture.
Oh, very nice. That's really beautiful.
Isn't that great? But it's time for a brief break. Here's the last musical break before the end of the show, or I should say before the end of the interview and then the end of the show.
Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue, and when he got here, he did what he came to do. He hacked off people's arms in his search for gold, of women, men, and children, young and old. George Washington was the richest ruler of a vast colony. He ran with an iron glove. Who went ahead with all the plans he made, with the British out to expand the slave trade? And if human liberation is the place where we are bound, then first we pull these statues to the ground. Jackson drove thousands across the plain with famine and death. He left the grasses stained. A proud racist and a killer ruling a slave state. If the society were sane, there would be no debate. Albert Pike was a general who invaded Mexico, where they had just ended human bondage, you know. But abolition could not stand, and Pike was on the side who thought that freedom must be violently defied. And if human liberation is the place where we are bound. Then first we pull these statues to the ground. Ulysses S. Grant was just another in a line of the overseers of imperial decline, who ordered his vast armies to go deport the Modoc people and kill all the buffalo. From Theodore to Franklin to the president today, an empire ruled the American way. The pedestals are broken. They can't bear the weight. Such a beautiful country. Such a failed state. If human liberation is the place where we are bound, then first we pull these statues to the ground. Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue, and when he got here, he did what he came to do.
And the notes that Rovix attaches to that song read as follows, and the song is called Pull Those Statues Down. Or, sorry, Pull These Statues to the Ground. The statues are only symbols, and whether they are disposed of by local authorities or taken down by members of the public, there's so much more to accomplish. But symbols are important, and taking these statues down is an important part of the process of reframing the mainstream historical narrative so that it might someday become an honest one. And now the final chapter of, or I should say the final half of, Keith McHenry's update.
Although,
I'm not particularly a fan of let's prove how clean and nice we are, and as they arrest us and do nasty things to our campgrounds by cleaning things up. I mean, that, the idea being that you can somehow tease a smile on the face of the oppressor by being nice and clean with them. I know it's sort of a nonviolent approach, but some would call it an ineffectual and unrealistic approach, too. Your response, nonviolent man?
That people can't take care of themselves, and which is not the case, because it's really the fact that city doesn't really provide resources to make it easy to clean things up. That's really more of a problem. So you're right on that. But there is the fact of helping people to have some systematic way of cleaning up is so overwhelming. Because you have the problem of if you just had like trash cans right there, adequately, and you just could do it, that would be reduced already. But the main problem is that people have to pile their trash next to trash cans. So anyway, that's one problem. The other one is pretty frustrating. There's no showers, and why that comes to mind is the fact that they have a water tap, which is fantastic. You can fill up 5-gallon buckets and so on down there. But the thing is that because there's no showers, people shower in it, and then it's become a swamp. So they have to build canals to direct the water away from people's tents and things. It's ludicrous.
You're talking about the Benchlands area. Well, I think what we heard at the last Union of the Homeless meeting, which will be coming up again tomorrow at 5 o'clock, as I understand it, right between in the tables outside the courthouse right on next to the Benchlands. There, I guess Greg and a couple and his compatriot tried to use the showers in the county building, which are modern. There are many of them. The deputies use them regularly and found that they were locked. So.
Yes, they just locked them. I've checked them out myself a few times.
How many showers are there down there? Did you notice?
I don't know what there is a door to a shower area, and I don't know what which is a glass door, which is, I don't know if it's just one shower in there, too.
And you also have been trying to get these.
In the one floor that I was on,
And you've also talked about
in the basement. There's another one. I don't know how many in the basement. investment.
That's the one I was thinking of. But you also mentioned at the last union meeting that your endless attempts to get the Association of Faith Communities to provide its, I would say, pathetic and limited mobile shower once a week, come and crowd in and line up to do a shower, has so far been, Steve is on vacation, whoever the Steve who is supposed to be handling that, I don't know what his last name, it's not Steve Plage.
No, that's not really got anything, there's no vacation occurring anymore. That's the story 2-3 weeks ago. No, it's moved way on beyond that. So,
but he still hasn't provided, no showers yet, right?
Steve Blair has said that we could do it every Friday. He got a permit from the city every Friday. Meet at 8:30 behind the duck pond. Everything will be great. And then I get an email on Friday after I've already been down there at 8:30. We can't do it. So both Steve emailed me and also John Shotwell or whatever his name is from the Association of Faith Communities, they couldn't do it. So even though we had agreed to fund it and...
We being Food Not Bombs?
Food Not Bombs, yeah. So it's like really frustrating after that, weeks and weeks. And it's sort of like they don't seem to get... I don't know what their problem is, that, you know, we offered, to insure it, liability insurance. We're just trying to get showers there.
It almost seems like an intentional obstruction.
And then the thing is also, there was everybody can just go down to Brent Adams' place, which is true, but a lot of people don't want to be that far away from their stuff that long. So if you're on a list waiting to get a shower, it's nice to be, at your place and be able to see the shower trailer at the same time.
Even if it's only once a week, huh?
Yeah, even if it's only once a week. So
what's the story with Brent's showers? How frequently do they do it down there?
I think he does it a couple of times a week. And then there's Greg was complaining that it was almost an entire... most of a day to get a shower at Housing Matters.
And there are showers. Are the showers open yet at the St. Francis Soup Kitchen?
I don't think so, no.
And I guess there are showers on the beach, right? I mean, they're cold showers.
Yeah. They occasionally turn them off, but I think they're on now. So
that's available for...
My house, I know people take showers out there, cold showers.
You've also been negotiating. I know the Union of the Homeless had numerous demands that it brought forward regarding, more availability of tent space in the benchlands itself. And has there been any problem with people who want to come in being told they can't come in, or is that?
I have not heard anybody come to me saying they were kept out of there. So that's good. I don't know.
But I understand they are restricting tents along the river.
I have not heard that recently, so I know at one point they were a while back, and I haven't heard that. I'm going to be down there today so I can find out.
So will you be attending Jeremy's meeting since he has come to yours?
No, if it's happening while I'm delivering food, yeah, but I'm not.
And have you been blocked from delivering food, or has that been resolved, that issue?
Well, he wasn't around the last few times I delivered food, so I don't know how that's going to be. So,
how many times has he blocked you if in the past?
Twice. The two times he's been there when I was there bringing food, he blocked me.
And you were bringing food on a weekly basis?
I kind of definitely every week, sometimes a couple of times a week.
And so out of, let's say, a couple of dozen times, he's only blocked you twice. Is that accurate?
Yeah, of every time he's blocked me 100% of the times that he's been there.
Right, but of the times that you've showed up, he has not made it a point to be there and block you.
No, he didn't come there intentionally to block me because then you have to wait there all day to.
You don't come at a regular time. You don't come at a regular time every on a regular day.
No, well, then for a short while there was every Friday at about 2:30 with Chris Cohen. He and I would do that. And then actually usually on that day, then I would come back sometime randomly after that, you know, like 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock was on my way out. And it's the last task. So I've done that. And now our whole pickup has changed to Thursday. So, and then Chris is out of town. So,